The rest of the USSR was compressed into a couple of years, in 1939 to 1941. Apart from the approximately 440,000 Polish civilians sent to camp, in September 1939 the Russians took about 200,000 Polish prisoners of war. Most of the officers and several thousand soldiers were sent to camps at Starobelsk, Kozielsk, and Ostashkov. In April 1940, there were about 15,000 of them there, including 8,700 officers. Only 48 were ever seen again. They had been removed from the camps and sent to Soviet prisons. The missing group included 800 doctors and a dozen university professors. When, under the agreement between the Poles and the Russians following the Soviet entry into the war, the former Polish prisoners were allowed to leave Russia and form their own army in the Middle East, the Polish representatives gave the Russians lists of names of soldiers who were known to have fallen into Russian hands and had not been released. The Polish ambassador, Professor Kott, raised the subject ten times with Molotov and Wyszynski between October 1941 and July 1942, and always received the reply that all the prisoners had been released. When Kott met Stalin in November 1941, Stalin made a call to the NKVD on the subject. Whatever the answer was, Stalin then went on to the next point and would not discuss the matter further. When General Sikorsky saw Stalin on December 3, 1941, he was told that perhaps the missing men had got over the border into Manchuria. But Stalin promised to look into the question, saying that if any Poles had not been released, through local obstruction by NKVD officers, the latter would be disciplined. In April 1943, the Germans announced the discovery of mass graves containing executed Poles in the cotton forest, near Smolensk. Within 2 days, the Russians produced a clear-cut official story of Polish officers in camps in the Smolensk area who had been left behind and had fallen into German hands, a totally different account from those which had previously been given by Stalin and his subordinates. Allied leaders, while not all actively accepting the Russian story, took the line that no trouble should now be caused in view of the overriding importance of unity against Hitler. The Western press, however, accepted the Russian version almost unanimously. The American military paper Stars and Stripes even published a caricature of a Polish officer, represented as pretending to have been killed by the Russians. The Germans allowed access to the cotton forest to a large number of expert or interested parties, a European medical commission, containing experts from universities all over Europe, including neutrals such as Dr. Naville, professor of forensic medicine at Geneva, representatives of the Polish underground, senior Allied prisoners of war, who correctly refused to pronounce any opinion, but who reported confidentially to their governments that the German story was quite clearly true. Basically, the proof consisted of digging up previously untouched mass graves, examining the corpses, compacted under earth, finding on them Soviet newspapers and similar material going up to April 1940, and nothing later, and noting that they were mostly in thick clothing, as against the Russian story that the executions had taken place in the warmth of September 1941. The bodies found at Kotyn, 4,143 in number, represented only those who had been in the Kozielsk camp, 2,914 were identified, and 80% of them were among the lists of missing the Polish authorities had assembled. What happened to the Poles from the other two camps, numbering about 10,400 men, remains unknown. There are stories that a number of Polish prisoners were packed into old barges and scuttled in the White Sea. And there are also tales of a mass execution and burial resembling Kotyn in the neighborhood of Kharkiv. The Nuremberg judges examined the Kotyn affair from 1 to July 3, 1946 in a derisory fashion, and did not mention Nazi responsibility for it in their verdict. No evidence of any sort has ever been forthcoming from German prisoners or captured material of Nazi responsibility for this particular crime. But it is now hardly necessary here to say more. It is nowhere believed any longer that the Germans were responsible. The significance, from the point of view of our theme, the purges, is that we have here a clear-cut example of a mass execution carried out, without trial and in complete secrecy, as a routine administrative measure, and in peacetime. One further case, this time of two individuals, is equally illustrative. Henryk Ehrlich and Viktor Alter, the leaders of the Jewish Bund Socialists in Poland, fell into Russian hands in September 1939 at the time of the Soviet-German invasion of Poland. They were both veterans of the Social Democratic movement in the old Russian Empire, and Ehrlich had been a member of the executive of the Petrograd Soviet in 1917. They were taken to the Butyrka, charged with acting for the Polish government in various infiltrations of saboteurs from 1919 to 1939. Ehrlich, who was on one occasion interrogated by Beria personally, insisted on writing all his answers. Alter replied simply to each question, "It is absolutely false, and you know it well." After 18 months, in July 1941, They were transferred to Saratov and condemned to death. They both refused to appeal, but after 10 days their sentences were commuted to 10 years imprisonment. The amnesty granted to all Polish prisoners shortly afterwards resulted in their release in September and October, respectively. They were asked to organize a Jewish anti-fascist committee, and it was clear that their connections with old members of the Bund and the American trade unions, such as David Dubinsky, were much valued. Ehrlich became president and alter secretary of this new organization, and the Soviet actor-producer Mikoyls was named a member of its presidium. Beria personally sponsored the organization, while telling them that on all international questions Stalin took the final decision. On 4 December, they went out of their hotel in Kuibyshev, and were never seen again. At first, the pretense was kept up that what had happened to them was unknown. But after protests from Clement Attlee and from the leading trade unionists in America and England, and also from important world figures like Albert Einstein and Reinhold Niebuhr, Litvinov finally, in February 1943, sent a letter to the head of the American Federation of Labor, William Green, explaining that Ehrlich and Alter had been arrested and executed for trying to persuade Soviet troops to cease contesting the advance of the German armies and to conclude an immediate peace with Nazi Germany. He added that they had been executed in December 1942, but their colleague, Lucian Blitt, who was with them in Kuibyshev until the moment of their arrest, believes that this is probably a mistake for December 1941. Cotton and the Ehrlich, Alter case are representative of a host of similar actions, both having exceptionally come to the notice of the world public through special circumstances. Apart from continuous attrition in the old lands of Russia, particular operations provided a flow of victims. After the Poles and Bates in 1939 to 1941, various other minorities were deported. In 1941, the Soviet Germans, in 1943 and 1944, seven entire nations, mainly from the Caucasus, were arrested and deported en bloc. German and Japanese prisoners of war filled the camps. In 1945 and 1946, the Western territories were again ravaged, and with the end of the war those Russian soldiers who had fought for, or merely been captured by, the Germans were mostly sent to camps on their return. The purge in the war. Meanwhile, in 1941 to 1945, the country had felt the effects of the measures taken by Stalin against his military leaders. Figures given over the past years vary slightly, depending on, for example, whether they refer to those holding ranks at the time of the original appointments in 1935, or include promotions made later. As now given in the Soviet press, the purge accounted for 3 of the 5 marshals, 13 of the 15 army commanders, 8 of the 9 fleet admirals and admirals grade I, 50 of the 57 corps commanders, 154 of the 186 divisional commanders, 16 of the 16 army commissars, 25 of the 28 corps commissars, 58 of the 64 divisional commissars. All 11 of the vice commissars of defense went, as did 98 out of 108 members of the Supreme Military Soviet. Nor was the effect confined to the upper echelons. Between May 1937 and September 1938, 36,761 army officers and over 3,000 navy officers were dismissed, of whom 9,579 had been arrested even before dismissal. But from 1939 to 1941, we are told, some 13,000 of these dismissed were re-enrolled, so that the total permanently repressed may be as low as 27,000. This omits, of course, those repressed after September 1938, for which Soviet figure is almost as high as those for 1937 and 1938 have been given, for a total over the whole period of 43,000, as Khrushchev later said, the purges started at company and battalion commander level. And the chances of the repressed seem to have been lower than those in any other field, of one group of 408 army men tried by the military collegium, 401 were shot and 7 sent to labor camp. The Soviet novelist Konstantin Simonov gives an account of a conversation between two generals, Serpilin and Ivan Alexeyevich, in his Soldiers Are Made, Not Born. Ivan Alexeyevich comments that the purge was not merely a matter of individual generals. The whole thing goes deeper. In the autumn of 1940, when the Finnish war had already ended, the Inspector General of the Infantry carried out an inspection of regimental commanders, and in the course of my duties I saw the resulting data. The review was attended by 225 commanders of infantry regiments. How many of them do you think had at that time graduated from the Frunze Academy? P. Cannot really guess, said Serpilin, judging from the preceding events, presumably not very many. What if I tell you that there was not a single one to have done so? T. Just cannot be. Don't believe it then, if you find that easier. Well, How many of the 225 do you think had gone through ordinary military college? 25 of them. And 200 of them had come from junior lieutenants' courses and regimental schools. As Ivan Alexeyevich himself points out, 225 regiments constitute 75 divisions, or half the strength of the peacetime army, a reasonable sample. What Simonov is saying, in effect, is that the army purge, plus the comparatively minor Finnish War of 1939 to 1940, accounted for virtually every single regimental commander throughout the entire Soviet army apart from those promoted to fill gaps higher up. Although fictional in form, the figures Simonov gives also appear in factual Soviet literature. Similarly, in his labor camp, Gorbatov wondered how the officers newly appointed to high rank, with no battle experience, would deal with operations in a real war. Honest, brave men, devoted to their country they might be, but yesterday's battalion commander would be head of a division, yesterday's regimental commander of a corps, in charge of an army, or a whole front, there would be at best a former divisional commander or his deputy. How many futile losses and failures would there be? What would our country suffer just because of this? Tilde. As is confirmed by Russian military writers, the purge had indeed led to inexperienced commanders being promoted. As early as 1937, 60% of the commanding cadres in rifle units, 45% in tank units, and 25% in air units were given as in this category. Moreover, the cadre of leaders who had gained military experience in Spain and in the Far East was almost completely liquidated. Nor could the atmosphere fail to affect the discipline of the army. The policy of large-scale repression against the military cadres led also to undermine military discipline, because for several years officers of all ranks and even soldiers in the party and Komsomol cells were taught to unmask their superiors as hidden enemies. It is natural that this caused a negative influence on the state of military discipline in the first war period. Meklis, in his report to the 1939 18th Congress, expressed horror and sorrow at incorrect expulsions from the party which had taken place in the army in 1935, 1936, and 1937, on the basis of slander, instead of the correct method of documents and facts. And over the next few years, a handful of generals were released, Rokossovsky and Gorbatov, for example. But still, as with the civilian purge, and the similar crocodile tears of Zhdanov, the arrests did not actually cease and cases continued to be processed. Herling mentions a number of Soviet generals with whom he shared a cell in 1940. Most of them had been badly beaten, and showed the marks of ill-mended broken bones. Even now, the Red Army had considerable striking power in the right hands. This was shown over the summer of 1939. After a very shaky start, a build-up of superior forces, itself a feat, luckily entrusted to the one superlative soldier of the old 1st Cavalry Army, Zhukov, threw back the Japanese invaders of Mongolia in model fashion at Khalkhin Gol. But even as this was being done, the armored tactics he had used, sponsored under Tukhachevsky, who with his group had by 1937 been beginning to create an elite army emerging from the mass, were being condemned and abandoned, and within 2 months the tactical doctrine of the Red Army was back to old-fashioned mess, and the tanks were distributed in packets to lesser unit commands. The post-purge promotions placed men totally unsuited or untrained for high command in key positions. None of them showed any capacity for strategic thinking, and even the tactical dispositions on the frontier were proof of a dull or listless mind. The rigidity of the military, political machine meant that failure at the top produced certain dislocation. The mass on which post-Tukhachevsky doctrine relied became too large and sluggish to be manipulated in such circumstances. In the Finnish War of 1939-1940, the initial incompetence of the Voroshilov, Meklis clique literally plunged the Red Army into disaster. Says John Erickson. He adds that apart from this high-level failure there was a fatal lack of the nerve that Tukhachevsky had insisted on in junior commanders, independence of spirit had been destroyed by the purges. The German General Staff's secret rating of the Red Army at the end of 1939 spoke of it as a gigantic military instrument. Although finding the principles of leadership good, it added the leadership itself is, however, too young and inexperienced. In 1940, German intelligence, warning against an underestimation of the Red Army, felt that nevertheless it would take 4 years before that army was back to its 1937 level of efficiency. There were two positive ingredients in the gloomy post-purge scene. First, Army Commander Shaposnikov, the Tsarist colonel, had never lost Stalin's trust. Through the debacle, he contrived to seek out and promote talent. As chief of staff his powers were limited, but he brought into the senior command posts a number of efficient officers, even though not enough to make up for those rising through the whims of Stalin, Meklis, and Voroshilov. Second, by great good luck, two of the old 1st Cavalry Army officers were fair, or good, soldiers. After Voroshilov's Finnish effort, Timoshenko, who had picked up the pieces and was now, May 7, 1940, a marshal, was made defense commissar. At the same time, Zhukov took the newly revived rank of full general, and then various key commands, culminating in his appointment as chief of staff in January 1941. The reforms which took place between 1940 and the German attack on Russia in 1941 were inadequate, but without them the Red Army would probably have been completely ruined in the first weeks of Hitler's assault. Timoshenko, in effect, attempted to restore the position as it had existed under Tukhachevsky. But 3 years of degeneration could not be recouped in a few months. Moreover, with Timoshenko, the grotesque Kulik, also from Stalinist Tsaritsyn entourage of the Civil War, and commonly described in the Soviet literature as a bullying incompetent, was made marshal and put in charge of the artillery arm, and another ineffective 1st Cavalry veteran, Tylinov, became full general, together with Zhukov and Meretskov, the latter arrested early in the war and confessing under torture to being a terrorist plotter, but released in September 1941. In fact, as a result of the 1940 promotions, 4 out of the 5 marshals, 2 out of the 3 full generals, and 2 of the new colonel generals were from Stalin's Civil War group. Of the 8, 2 were to prove useful appointments. The others ranged from mediocre to disastrous. Stalin's concessions to military reality were not yet wholehearted. We can be reasonably certain that but for the sharp jolt of the Finnish War, Timoshenko would not have been allowed to carry out his partial program of revitalization. The task was tremendous, indeed, given the circumstances, impossible. But some improvement could be effected. The dual command system was, after all, abandoned on August 12, 1940. In September, Mekhlis was removed from the political administration of the army. A partial reversion to Tukhachevsky's training methods set in. To create a new leadership and a new spirit could nevertheless not be done in the time remaining. Timoshenko was a vast improvement on Voroshilov, but the latter, and a large number of Stalinist arrivists, remained in positions of power. And Stalin himself, with his long refusal to face the possibility of a German attack, was in final control. When the German invasion was on the point of being launched, a leading commentator was doubtful whether any consistent plan for the defense of the Soviet Union existed, even at this late hour. Stalin's attitude towards the Nazi-Soviet Pact of 1939 is one of the most peculiar things about his entire career. The man who had never attached the slightest value to verbal assurances or paper promises does really seem to have thought, or hoped, that Hitler would not attack Russia. Even when overwhelming evidence was sent to him, by Soviet intelligence, by the British, by German deserters, that the Nazis were massing for attack, he gave strict orders that such reports should be treated as provocations. As far as can be seen, it was in the genuine hope of persuasion that he remarked to Schulenburg, "We must remain friends," and told Colonel Krebs, "We will remain friends with you in any event." During the 1939-1941 period, attacks on the British were encouraged, but no mention even of the word fascism was allowed. The counselor of the Soviet embassy in Paris, Nikolai Ivanov, was actually sentenced to 5 years for anti-German views, and the sentence was confirmed, doubtless through bureaucratic inefficiency, in September 1941. As an old Soviet diplomat remarked, the 2 years gained by the Nazi-Soviet pact were almost completely wasted. He commented sourly, he suspected his own closest comrades, but he trusted Hitler. It has been said that so much genuine enmity had been focused on Trotsky that Hitler, in comparison, seemed a shadowy figure, a bogeyman for use in frightening the party rather than a real threat. There may be an element of truth in this, psychologically speaking. But Stalin's lack of contact with reality on the one point of the Nazi invasion had not been reflected in his attitude to Soviet-German relations during the earlier part of the pact's duration. In 1939 and 1940, the Soviet Union had bargained hard, had refused to make definite commitments, and, though providing the Germans with various services appropriate to an ally such as the U-boat base north near Murmansk, had conducted even the lowest level negotiations with all the self-centered closeness and suspiciousness later shown in relations with the Anglo-American allies of a subsequent phase of the war period. The complete withdrawal from reality in the face of unpleasant facts is very much the aberration of 1941. It seems likely that Stalin, realizing the incapacity of his army and his regime in the face of the Germans, hoped against hope at least for a further year or two's grace. Everything had gone his way for years. He could scarcely, it seems, conceive of his luck failing. Be that as it may, The result of his attitude was the despairing and absurd messages which poured in from the frontier on 22nd of June, "We are being fired on. What shall we do?" And yet the Soviet army was larger in numbers, stronger in materiel, and at least as well equipped technically as the German invaders. There was only one element in which the armies were not comparable: the German command, staff, and officer corps in general were of immensely superior quality. Although Hitler had removed a number of the higher officers, he had at least the sense to see that he could not fight a major war without a trained military cadre. As the armies facing the Germans broke up under a task for which they had not been properly prepared or supported, Stalin reacted promptly. The commander of the Western Front, Pavlov, his chief of staff, Klimovskiy, and his signals and artillery commanders were shot. General Korobkov, commanding the battered Fourth Army, followed them. This did not save the three armies and four mechanized corps trapped between Minsk and Vladivostok. The Air Force, with 10,000 to 11,000 machines to the Luftwaffe's 5,000, was almost annihilated in the first days of the war. A large proportion of Soviet aircraft were not of modern type. And the other faults of Stalin's rule. In the Air Force reinforced the errors of industrial and design policy. First, training had been inadequate, and tactical methods were poor. Kesselring applied the term infanticide to the Luftwaffe's destruction of Soviet bomber formations. And all these long-established errors were compounded by Stalin's last and most fateful blunder, the failure to believe in the imminence of attack. Large parts of the Air Force were caught on the ground and destroyed in the first hours. General Kopets, of the Air Arm, committed suicide, having lost 600 aircraft while imposing negligible damage on the Luftwaffe, and others were arrested and shot. For example, General Chernik, commander of an aviation division in the Western Front, who had lost 7/8 of his command, and General Tukhin, commander of the Kiev District Air Force. In all, between June and August 1941, about 8,500 Soviet planes were lost. The Russians also had a great superiority in the number of tanks, 11,000 or 12,000 to 4,300, and here design had not fallen behind. The original Soviet tank defeats can be attributed almost entirely to bad tactical methods and worse staff work. In his biography of Stalin, Isaac Deutsche mentions that imprisoned officers, like survivors of the purged opposition, were brought out of concentration camps and assigned to important work. This needs to be qualified. 300 experienced officers were being held in the Lubyanka in October 1941 while at the front battalions were being commanded by lieutenants. A Soviet account refers to two lists of men inside who were liquidated in October 1941 and July 1942, respectively, at times when Stalin considered the situation to be desperate. The October executions included, on the 28th of that month, and after severe torture, Colonel General Stern, three successive heads of the Soviet Air Force Loktionov, Smushkevich, and Rychagov, and a number of other senior officers, mainly artillery or air force, with three of their wives. They were shot without trial, on an administrative order from Beria. Moreover, a Soviet marshal makes it clear that while some of the officers brought out of camps and rehabilitated gave good service, in many cases the men concerned had been ruined, the moral, and often also the physical sufferings undergone in the prisons and camps had killed in them all the will, initiative and decisiveness necessary for a military man. He gives the example of a general, a Civil War hero who had been wounded 11 times, who was arrested and sentenced in 1939 to 20 years imprisonment without any charges being presented apart from the simple formula "enemy of the people." In a camp of severe regime, he became a bath attendant and was given 5 years more for stealing a few underclothes. He was released in 1943 and made chief of staff of an army, but his sufferings had broken his character. The horse marshals commanded in 1941, all three from the old 1st Cavalry Army. Timoshenko, in the center, proved reasonably competent, though he, too, suffered heavy losses. On the southern and northern flanks, Badeni and Voroshilov were merely catastrophic, especially the former. Stalin's other protege, Marshal Kulik, came to grief in a clumsy operation before Leningrad. General Tylinov became involved in the disasters in the Ukraine. All four were removed, but none was shot, except, apparently, Kulik, but only after the war. As late as 1957, Tylinov was defending Stalin's Lvov operations of 1920, the old wound in the side of the Soviet army which had festered so long and so desperately. With superior Soviet resources and vastly lengthened German communications, it was still only possible to avoid total defeat for three reasons. First was the continued existence of further reserves. Second was Allied aid. Third, and most important, was the selection of better commanders. This could only be done in the course of the endless battles of the Great Retreat. The incompetents who had been put in to replace an adequate command in 1937 and 1938 were weeded out by disaster. A new and efficient command was created by natural selection in the struggle itself. It was purchased, in fact, with the lives of hundreds of thousands of Russian soldiers, with hundreds of miles of Russian territory, and with a great prolongation of the war. Tukhachevsky's military doctrines were reinstated in the directives of the Stavka for the counteroffensive at Moscow in 1941. The turn had come. But, as a Soviet army officer once remarked to the author, it was owing to the purges that the road to Berlin involved the long and painful detour via Stalingrad. Far from the Great Purge eliminating a Soviet Fifth Column, it laid the foundation for one throughout the country in 1941-1945. This was the first war fought by Russia in which a large force of its citizens joined the other side. Among the more brilliant younger officers who had survived the purge was General Vlasov. In the maneuvers of 1940, his 99th Division had proved the best. A tall, powerful man with a stentorian voice and a fine flow of invective, he was, Ilya Ehrenberg tells us, popular with the troops and in favor with Stalin, who could not recognize a genuine potential traitor. Vlasov, when captured, organized the Russian troops on the German side, in spite of great difficulties with the Nazi authorities. His program shows that he was entirely out of sympathy with Nazism, and only concerned with a democratic Russia. He was comparable, in fact, to the Irish revolutionaries of 1916 who sought German support against Britain, or the Burmese and Indonesians of the Second World War who came to agreements, or tried to, with the Japanese against the West. As a Polish prisoner in Russia remarks more generally, of the expectations in the labor camps. I think with horror and shame of a Europe divided into two parts by the line of the bug, on one side of which millions of Soviet slaves prayed for liberation by the armies of Hitler, and on the other millions of victims of German concentration camps awaited deliverance by the Red Army as their last hope. Ehrenberg's implication that Stalin was effective at dealing with imaginary traitors is sound. In 1941, he destroyed the last remnants of alternative political leadership. Antipov was apparently shot on 24 August. In September, the survivors of the 1938 trial still in prison, Rakovsky, Pletnev, Besenov, were retried and shot, as was Maria Spyridonova, the social revolutionary leader. In October, two more political figures, former members of the Central Committee Golashchikin and Bolotov, were shot with the Stern, Loktionov group of officers. It seems that such acts were widespread. A poll mentions, in the Yurtsevo camp, two generals, four lawyers, two journalists, four students, a high-ranking NKVD officer, two former camp administrators, and five other assorted nobodies being selected and shot in June 1941. In fact, the outbreak of war was made the occasion for a general increase in police activity and power. Individual grudges were paid off, and potential malcontents dealt with, as with the case of the widow of the deputy People's Commissar of the NKVD in the Ukraine, Brunivoy, who had died under interrogation. She was arrested in 1937 and severely interrogated, with permanent injury to the kidneys and several broken ribs. She was released in 1939 and rehabilitated. She believed throughout that everything that had happened was the result of hostile elements in the NKVD, and wrote to Stalin and Vyshinsky to this effect. At the beginning of 1941, the NKVD officials in her case were tried and sentenced to short terms of imprisonment for the use of torture. She felt herself completely justified. 2 days after the German invasion, on June 24, 1941, she disappeared once more. When the Russians withdrew before the German advance, attempts were made to evacuate NKVD prisoners. Not only was their labor needed, but they were, of course, expected to sympathize with liberators, even German ones. The retreat was so disorganized, especially in the Ukraine, that evacuation was often impossible. Killings on a mass scale took place. These are reported from Minsk, Smolensk, Kiev, Kharkov, Dnipropetrovsk, Zaporozhye, and throughout the Baltic states. Near Nalchik, in the Caucasus, there was a molybdenum combinat operated by the NKVD with convict labor. The prisoners were machine-gunned on the orders of the Kabardino-Balkar Republic's NKVD commissar. There is another report of a group of 29,000 prisoners accumulated in the Soviet retreat. When threatened with a further German advance and the abandonment of the camp at Olginskaya, the NKVD released all those serving less than 5 years and on October 31, 1941 shot the remainder. More generally, we are told that mass shootings took place in the camps in November 1941, when the Germans were at the gates of Moscow, in early June 1942, and in September 1942, when Stalingrad seemed about to fall won. And yet the war was also an occasion for the relaxation of certain pressures. Religion, for example, was no longer persecuted. The public reversion to the old patriotism heartened at least the Russians. Above all, there was everywhere hope that once the war finished, things would become easier, the collective farm system would be abolished, the terror would end. Even apart from the sanguine mood of the people, the war brought a feeling of release, as Pasternak's characters remark. You could volunteer for frontline service in a punitive battalion, and if you came out alive you were free. After that, attack after attack, mile after mile of electrified barbed wire, mines, mortars, month after month of artillery barrage. They called our company the Death Squad. It was practically wiped out. How and why I survived, I don't know. And yet, imagine, all that utter hell was nothing, it was bliss compared to the horrors of the concentration camp, and not because of the material conditions but for some other reason. It was not only felt by men in your position, in concentration camps, but by everyone without exception, at home and at the front, and they all took a deep breath and flung themselves into the furnace of this deadly, liberating struggle with real joy, with rapture. The consolidation of Stalinism. But in proposing the toast at the victory banquet in the Kremlin in June 1945, Stalin spoke significantly of the ordinary people as cogs in the wheels of the great state apparatus. His intention, completely fulfilled, was the restoration of the old machine. In the same month, it was made clear that the confession trial system had been abandoned after 1938 because it was, in the then circumstances, no longer necessary, rather than because Stalin thought it unconvincing or useless. 16 leaders of the Polish underground government and army were placed on trial. The accused were headed by General Okolicki, who had taken over command of the Home Army following the surrender of General Borka Morawski after the heroic Warsaw Rising, and Jankowski, the chief delegate in Poland of the Polish government. Okolicki, then underground, had been asked to contact the Soviet command, with a guarantee of safe conduct, but was arrested when he presented himself. They and 13 of their 14 co-defendants pleaded guilty to charges of anti-Soviet activity. This was the last of the great public trials to be held in Moscow. Its aim was to discredit the Polish resistance and to bring pressure on the Polish government in exile to enter into a coalition with the communist-sponsored Lublin Committee, then ruling Soviet-occupied Poland, on terms adequate to secure communist predominance. Although no more such trials were seen in Moscow, all over Eastern Europe the old method was employed, under direct Russian control. First, as in Russia, against non-party elements, such as the agrarian leader Nikola Petkov in Bulgaria and Cardinal Mendszenty in Hungary, and later with communist leaders like Laszlo Rajk in Hungary and Trajko Kostov in Bulgaria. The system of public confession to entirely false charges came to an abrupt halt in December 1949 TM when Kostov, secretary of the Central Committee of the Bulgarian Communist Party, retracted his confession in open court and maintained this stand throughout the trial. Kostov refused to change his mind in spite of the moral indignation of the court and the tearful appeals of his co-accused. Kostov was perhaps in a stronger position than most accused in earlier trials. He must long ago have become accustomed to the idea of death and torture in pursuit of his political aims. His conduct under fascist interrogation had been held up as an example to the Bulgarian Communist Party. He was still close to the period of his illegal life and had not, as perhaps Bukharin and others had gone to seat after years of comfort. Moreover, he knew that the bulk of his party was silently behind him, and thus, perhaps, did not feel quite the isolation of the Russian oppositionists. In addition, he seems to have been particularly tough. In him, typical Bulgarian mulishness and resilience were developed to a high degree. In Russia itself, there were almost no death sentences for 3 or 4 years after the war, apart from those on a few leading Vlasovites. Genuine collaborators with the Germans had been rounded up by the tens of thousands, and merely sentenced to labor camps, where they were joined by the Soviet soldiers returned from internment in Germany. In 1946 and 1947, a great wave of arrests struck at Jews, army officers, and others, and soon afterwards all those who had been released in the meanwhile were again arrested. This reversal of an act of rotten liberalism was given official authorization by a decree of 1950, said to have been adopted on the initiative of Beria and Abakumov. Trademark. The camps were at first more deadly than ever. Of those sentenced in 1945 and 1946, few survived by 1953. The famine of 1947 was, of course, reflected in the camp rations, with the usual results. By the beginning of the 1950s, however, a reform and rationalization of the forced labor system led to a drop in the death rate. Since almost no releases took place, one coatless commandant is quoted as saying that he had been in his post for 8 years and had released one prisoner. The camp population mounted, by Stalin's death, to its probable maximum of approximately 12 million. This general consolidation of the labor camp system reflected a consolidation of the whole state and economy into the form Stalin had evidently been aiming at since his achievement of full power. In the new society, forced labor was evidently intended as permanent economic form. What Stalin had established was essentially a command economy and a command society. This applied at every level. The collective farms, with their tractors, were producing less food than the ill-equipped Mudok of 1914. But they were now economically and politically under control. They could no longer hold the market to ransom. And so it was the whole way up the scale. Everywhere, orders from the center were not merely binding in principle, but enforceable in practice. There was no significant area in which the important decisions could not be taken in the Kremlin. The resemblances between this and socialism, as Marx and others had envisaged it, were, formally speaking, not negligible. The capitalist no longer existed. The petty bourgeois individual peasant had gone. The state controlled the economy. For those who held that in a modern industrial society the absence of capitalists could only mean socialism, this was enough. Defined more positively, socialism had indeed always had one further characteristic, in effect, its very keystone. The control of the state by the proletariat had been regarded as the essential. In Stalin's Russia, there was no sign at all of any such thing. This point was got over by verbal means. All the phraseology of the workers' state was employed, in every conceivable context. One may wonder how far Stalin thought that he had produced the socialism the securing of which he had, as a young man, been converted to. There was indeed no longer any ruling class. Although Stalin created, and admitted he was creating, a large privileged stratum, it had no rights of ownership over the means of production. Every privilege was held, in the last analysis, at the whim of the ruler. In this unitary system, politics as such had disappeared, except in the form of intrigue at the highest level for Stalin's favor. In a sense, this may sound paradoxical, there was more political agitation and propaganda in the press and on the radio, in factory speeches and official literature, than anywhere in the world. But it was totally passive. It consisted solely of the handing down of, and working up of enthusiasms for, the decisions of the General Secretary. A new generation of industrial managers had risen, competent in the techniques of administration, in which the threat of the forced labor camp spurred on the directors, just as a piecework system drove the worker to his limits by the threat of hunger. The new industrialists, even those at the highest level, like Tavazian, Malyshev, and Saburov, were little more than the unquestioning technicians of the new scheme of things. The planning system, which had been quite chaotic in the 1930s, now settled into a new rationality. Increases in productivity, at least in the heavy industrial production which was Stalin's main interest, at last became regular. The system had huge wastages and inefficiencies. Its planning was, in many fields, largely mythical. And the general unworkability of its distribution network was made up for by a large extra-legal market. But, all in all, the economy Stalin had created was at least an operating reality. Its built-in wastages were not great enough to prevent achievement of its main aim, the continuing investment in industry of a high proportion of the national income. They were, however, great enough to hold the expansion bought at such sacrifice down to a level lower than that of various capitalist countries. Detailed comparisons were in any case impossible to make, owing to the secrecy and distortion of the Soviet statistical system of the time. But what provided confidence to the party elite, and gained the admiration of certain intellectuals abroad, was the more general fact that industry had been created in a fairly backward country. It was hoped that the method might be applicable in the really backward lands of the East. But the old Russia had not been all that backward. It had already been the fourth industrial power before the revolution. In the reign of Nicholas II, the railway network had doubled in length in 10 years, and there had been a great upsurge in the mining and metal industries. As Lenin said, "The progress in the mining industry is more rapid in Russia than in Western Europe and even in North America." In the last few years, 1886, 1896, the production of cast metal has tripled. The development of capitalism in the younger countries is accelerated by the example and aid of the older .equals. And the trend continued right up to 1914. Since 1930, Stalin had enlarged the industrial base. But he had done so by very wasteful methods, far more wasteful economically, and in human suffering, than those of the original industrial revolution. He had not made the best use of his resources, solving the problem of rural overpopulation by removing precisely the most productive section of the peasantry, and wasting much of the original skilled engineering force by decimating it on false charges of sabotage. It is true, indeed, that a high proportion of Russia's skill had been killed or had emigrated during the revolution itself. Even in 1929 it was reasonably clear, economically speaking, that milder measures could have produced equally good results, as they had in Meiji Japan, for example. As long ago as Khrushchev's time, Communist, the main theoretical and political organ of the Central Committee, summed up the charges against Stalin's planning system. He personally interfered with the work of planning organizations, enforced arbitrary goals, and radically changed plans in a way that made whole sections of them meaningless. He thus inflicted lasting harm on the Soviet planning work and on the Soviet economy. Indeed, Communist went on, it was Stalin who was responsible for lasting troubles in the Soviet economy which, to cover up his personal guilt, he used to ascribe to difficulties allegedly inherent in the rapid growth of the economy. In particular, arbitrary planning caused immense damage to agriculture which still suffers from the results of the cult of Stalin's personality. Few would now maintain that Stalin's method was the only, or the best, way available, even to a one-party regime, to attain the degree of increased industrialization actually realized. But in any case, the basic economic benefits obtained, or supposedly obtained, by the Stalin regime were already in hand before the purge proper started. Economically, in fact, there is no doubt that the purge was disadvantageous. It removed a high proportion of the most skilled industrial leaders, from Pyatakov down, and at the same time, the camps were filled from an already overstretched labor pool. The rationale was that not of economics, but of despotism. With all the incentives to attain, or at least claim, the opposite, economic advance admittedly slowed down in 1938 to 1940.7. The lesson might seem to be that the use of terror in conditions when it may seem to some degree economically effective is nevertheless not a good idea even economically. For it cannot simply be switched off. It builds up its own interests and institutions, its own cadres and habits of mind. Any good it may be, in this sense, at a particular moment is likely to be offset at a later stage when it is no longer applicable, but still applied. But even if one were to accept the Stalin method as a whole, writing off later losses as the inevitable payment for earlier successes, other issues arise. Stalinism might be one way of attaining industrialization, just as cannibalism is one way of attaining a high-protein diet. The desirability of the result hardly seems to balance the objections. Meanwhile, Stalin pervaded every sphere. In philosophy, for example, he was celebrated as a profound critic of Hegel, as the first to elucidate certain pronouncements of Aristotle, as the only man to bring out the full significance of Kant's theories. On the tercentenary of Spinoza's birth, Pravda had put in several quotations from Stalin, having nothing to do with Spinoza or even philosophy. At a Moscow conference of experts held in 1963, a historian complained that in the post-war period it was impossible frankly to share one's thoughts and doubts even with one's comrades, for fear of placing them in a difficult position. Academician Yevgeny M. Zhukov spoke of the psychological trauma suffered by historians who were systematically imbued with the idea that theoretically sound works could only be written by a select vosht and that profound thoughts and fresh deeds could proceed only from him. Thus for almost 20 years, the period of the formation of the consciousness of a whole generation, independent creative thought by ordinary mortals in the sphere of theory was placed in doubt. A doctor, denouncing the effect on Soviet medicine, summed up the main harm caused to science by the cult of the personality lay in the proclamation of a single opinion, an inexhaustible fount of wisdom as the supreme truth. It is not accidental that in the course of discussions of concrete scientific problems, one concept or another was not verified by the experiments of its proposers but by references to scientific heritage, by mere quotation from the works of others. In the even more sensitive field of economics, independent thought was naturally treated with greater rigor. The director of the Institute of Economics of the USSR Academy of Sciences remarked in 1962. Many communists can still remember the havoc wreaked in the 40s on the journal Problems of Economics for publishing an article by Professor Kubanin. In this article he expressed the completely correct thought that we were lagging behind America in labor productivity and agriculture. The great scholar and major expert on the economics of agriculture paid for this correct thought with his life, while the journal was closed for its heresy. The effect of the Stalinist attitude at the lower level is adumbrated by the first secretary of the Georgian Communist Party, Amglazi, who summoned workers from the Institute of Marxism-Leninism and the Institute of History of the Georgian Academy of Science and had them write a book on the history of the party in Transcaucasia. When he was given the result, he announced, "I, as the author, like it. But be sure if there are any mistakes in it, you, dear friends, will all go to prison. Again, Stalin happened to say in an aside that the Azerbaijanis were obviously descended from the Medes. Although there is no basis for such a notion, it became established doctrine among the historians. Linguists spent 15 years trying to find Median words in Azeri. Eventually 35 dubious Median words were found, although the Median language itself is mythical. These few examples, which omit, for instance, the major scandal of Lysenkoism in Soviet biology, must serve as a general impression of the effect of Stalin's new regime on the intellect. In the less stormy atmosphere of the post-Yuzhnev years, moreover, more careful attention could be paid to thought crime and face crime. An authoritative instruction, typical of many, ran: "One must not content oneself with merely paying attention to what is being said, for that may well be in complete harmony with the party program. One must pay attention also to the manner, to the sincerity, for example, with which a schoolmistress recites a poem the authorities regard as doubtful, or the pleasure revealed by a critic who goes into detail about a play he professes to condemn." The last years of Stalin's life saw a major, though unpublicized, series of purges. In 1949-1950 came a new Leningrad case. Voznesensky, member of the Politburo, A. Kuznetsov, secretary of the Central Committee, and other leaders were shot. About 3,000 senior party members in Leningrad were arrested, and treated with particular brutality, many of them being shot, and there were similar purges elsewhere. In 1952 and 1953, leading Jewish intellectuals perished by the hundred, and a wave of arrests culminated in the doctor's plot, with Stalin ordering the investigators, beat, beat and beat again, as Khrushchev tells us. Stalin's execution of the main Yiddish writers in the Crimean Affair of 1952 is among the most extraordinary of all state acts. As Manny Sperber has said, these were communists who had submitted to all the imperatives of the regime and of Stalin. Like the others, they had betrayed their friends and their brothers every time that fidelity to the party demanded it, but they were to die because they remained incapable of betraying their language and their literature. Not long before Stalin died, Pravda, by an extraordinary exception, published an article by Herbert Morrison, the British Foreign Secretary. It calmly but cogently set forth democratic objections to the Soviet system. An answer appeared at once, saying that Morrison was asking for freedom of speech for those it would be wrong to give it to, the criminals who killed Kirov. It now turns out that it was precisely those people, and no others, who had freedom of speech. The Stalinist version of the events of the purge was, of course, the only one permitted in Russia itself. Many people there knew at first hand that this version was false, but anyone susceptible of indoctrination by terror or by sheer pressure of propaganda fell in with the official line. Abroad, things were different. The West was not forced to accept the Stalinist version. Freedom of judgment and freedom of information prevailed, then as now. This did not prevent an extraordinary degree of success for the official communist view. Foreign misapprehensions. If thou canst not realize the ideal, thou shalt at least idealize the real. Calverley. During the purges, a young English communist, John Cornford, published a poem. Sergei Mironovich, Kirov, assassinated in Leningrad, December 1934. Nothing is ever certain, nothing is ever safe. Today is overturning yesterday's settled good. Everything dying keeps a hungry grip on life. Nothing is ever born without screaming and blood. Understand the weapon, understand the wound. What shapeless past was hammered to action by his deeds. Only in constant action was his constant certainty found. He will throw a longer shadow as time recedes. Cornford, with a first-class record at Cambridge University, went to Spain in 1936 and was killed near Cordoba, with the International Brigade, at the end of that year. There can hardly be a better illustration of the way in which the generous impulse in Western communism could be befouled by Stalinism. The young man who gave his life in the cause of a supposed revolutionary humanism had been led by his allegiances to produce what is little more than a versification of Stalin's theory that the class struggle grows more bitter as the opponents of communism become weaker, using as its text a crime allegedly committed by counter-revolutionaries, but actually by Stalin himself. Time having, as Cornford suggests, receded, what has become plain is that not even high intelligence and a sensitive spirit are of any help once the facts of a situation are deduced from a political theory, rather than vice versa. Although Cornford's case is instructive, and not only as regards his own time, he was not among those actively responsible for propagating and compounding the falsehood, he was, rather, at the receiving end. Between those in the West who accepted the Stalinist version of events and those who originally issued that version, there stood a number of journalists, ambassadors, lawyers, and students of Russia, whose direct and admitted duty it was to study the facts in detail and pronounce on them. Not every Western communist, or every left-wing intellectual, could be expected to read with a critical eye the official reports of the great trials. Those who did, or who had actually attended them, and who from incompetence and blind, or cynical, partisanship transmitted a false analysis to the larger audience, may reasonably be thought somewhat blameworthy. A few examples of inadequate skepticism have already been noted. Any recorder of these events must be tempted to compile a vast sodicier of misjudgments made by his compatriots and others in the West. It is scarcely a point that should be ignored, but it has been thought best to give no more than a few examples of the type of error which was made by many with high claims to clear judgment, moral enlightenment, and political knowledge. The contemporary effect on world opinion was an important aspect of the whole purge operation. Stalin had himself considered it when he ordered the Zinoviev trial. He is not impressed by the argument that public opinion in Western Europe must be taken into consideration. To all such arguments he replies contemptuously, "Never mind, they'll swallow it." Equals. The fact that so many did swallow it was thus certainly a factor in making the whole purge possible. The trials, in particular, would have carried little weight unless validated by some foreign, and so independent, commentators. Foreign intervention had, as late as the mid-1930s, been able to secure certain results, particularly in view of Stalin's post-1935 policy of alliances. For example, in June 1935, the International Congress of Writers for the Defense of Culture was held in Paris. It was intended as a large-scale popular front occasion. Magdalene Paz insisted on raising the case of Victor Serge, arrested in 1932. After an uproar, in which she was supported by Salvini and Gide, she was allowed to speak. The Soviet delegation consisted of Pasternak, Nikolai Tikhonov, Ilya Ehrenberg, Mikhail Koltsov, and the playwright Kershin, the two last to perish shortly. Apart from Pasternak, these Soviet delegates resisted the debate strenuously and accused Serge of complicity in the Kirov murder, which had taken place 2 years after his arrest. Afterward, Gide went and conveyed the writer's displeasure to the Soviet ambassador. Serge was released at the end of the year. This is an almost unique occasion on which foreign opinion was able to influence Stalin. It seems to show, however, that if articulate Western opinion had condemned the Zinoviev trial with sufficient unanimity and force, it is conceivable that Stalin might, in this popular front period, have acted at least slightly less ruthlessly. In fact, those who swallowed the trials can hardly be acquitted of a certain degree of complicity in the continuation and exacerbation of the torture and execution of innocent men. The facts that were concealed from, or by, progressive opinion in the West were twofold: the existence and extent of the mass slaughter and imprisonment, and the inconsistency and falsehood of the public trials. From the start, there were three basic objections to the evidence in the trials. First, the alleged plots were totally out of character with the accused leaders, who had always opposed individual assassination, and were now, moreover, charged also with having been enemy agents throughout their careers. Second, the allegations were often inherently absurd, like the charge against Zelensky that he had put nails into the masses' butter with a view to undermining Soviet health. Third, some of the stories told in court were of events abroad, which could be checked. These contained demonstrable falsehoods: a meeting at a non-existent hotel in Copenhagen, a landing at a Norwegian airfield during a month when no landings had taken place. In the West, the facts were readily available. Hundreds of articles and books were published in which all these points were clearly and flatly demonstrated. Trotsky, the one accused at liberty, exposed the frame-up with incisive skill. The distinguished commission headed by Professor Dewey examined the whole evidence in the most judicious and meticulous fashion, and published its findings. It was not a question of political argument, properly speaking, but of facts. Yet in spite of everything, these went unheard among large sections of well-informed people. There was no reasonable excuse for believing the Stalinist story. The excuses which can be advanced are irrational, though often couched in the formulas of intensive rationalization. The Communist parties everywhere simply transmitted the Soviet line. Communist intellectuals, some of them better informed about Soviet conditions and more inclined to frame their own answers, reacted variously. There were those who simply repressed the difficult material. Stephen Spender quotes an English communist friend, when asked what he thought of the trials, as replying, "What trials? I have given up thinking about such things long ago." Equals. More representative was the attitude of Bertolt Brecht, who remarked to Sidney Hook at the time of the first trials, "The more innocent they are, the more they deserve to die." Meanwhile, he had written a play about Nazi Germany: a father and mother are worried because friends of theirs are under investigation, and they fear the block warden. The husband, a teacher, does not know if they have anything against him at the school. I am ready to teach whatever they want me to teach. But what do they want me to teach? If only I were sure of that. They worry about whether to put Hitler's picture in a more prominent position, or whether that will look like a confession of guilt. Wife, but there's nothing against you, is there? Husband, there's something against everybody. Everybody is suspected. It's enough if someone expresses any suspicion of you, to make you a suspected person. And later one remarks, since when have they needed witnesses? Equals. But the main theme of the play, taken as completely destroying the moral basis of Nazism, is the father's and mother's fear that their schoolboy son may have denounced them. This was at a time when, as Brecht evidently knew, the same sort of thing was going on in the Soviet Union. In fact, there was a widely praised and celebrated Soviet example of sons denouncing their parents. During collectivization, Pavlik Morozov, leader of his village group of young communist pioneers who were acting as auxiliaries in the attack on the peasantry, unmasked his father, who had previously been president of the village Soviet but had fallen under the influence of kulak relations. The father was shot, and on September 3, 1932, a group of peasants, including the boy's uncle, in turn killed the son, at the age of 14, thus, as it were, anticipating Stalin's age limit for executions. All the killers were themselves executed, and young Morozov became, until very recently, a great hero of the Komsomol. The Palace of Culture of the Red Pioneers in Moscow was named after him. Even in the Khrushchev period, the Soviet press celebrated the sacred and dear Pavlik Morozov Museum in his own village. In this timbered house was held the court at which Pavlik unmasked his father who had sheltered the kulaks. Here are reliquaries dear to the heart of every inhabitant of Gerasimovka. Equals. In Brecht's own case, it is noteworthy that a close connection, his former mistress the actress Carola Neyer, who had played the lead in the Dreigrischen Oper, was arrested in Russia and never seen again. As Hubert Ludi has argued, Brecht himself was not attracted to communism as part of the workers' movement, which he had never known, but by a deep urge for a total authority, a total submission to a total power, the new Byzantine state church, immutable, hierarchical, founded on the infallibility of the leader. His political and semi-political work invariably shows this pleasure at rolling in the muck for the sake of the idea. It seems to represent an extreme and degenerate version of Pyatakov's view of the party. It is perhaps natural that committed communists should in principle have accepted and propagated untruths, in the old tradition of pious fraud. But curiously enough, such a consideration seems partially to apply also to many elements of the non-communist left. Not in such a clear-cut manner, not so fraudulently or so piously, they yet tended to temper criticism, to put the best complexion on, or ignore, refractory events. There was, indeed, much resistance among the tougher-minded left. Edmund Wilson, reading the charges against Zinoviev and Kamenev while still in Russia, saw at once that they were faked. In the United States, the Dewey Commission had as its lawyer John F. Finnerty, who had appeared for the defense in the Mooney and Sacco, Vonsetti trials. The liberal Manchester Guardian was the strongest and most effective of British exposers of the trials. The Orthodox Labour Party press did the same. That party also put out Frederick Adler's forthright and accurate pamphlet on the subject. And on the extreme left, some of the most effective exposure was done by Emrys Hughes and the Scottish Forward. In fact, some leftists, and not only Trotskyists and so on, who had a direct partisan interest, were perfectly clear-headed about the matter, while some people opposed to the principles of communism accepted the official versions. But on the whole, in the atmosphere of the late 1930s, fascism was the enemy, and a partial logic repressed or rejected any criticism of its supposed main enemy, the USSR. The Western capitals thronged with the thousands of painters and writers and doctors and lawyers and debutantes chanting a diluted version of the Stalinist line. Appeals in favor of the trials were made by various Western writers, Feucht Wunger, Brabus, even the sensitive Gandhi fan, Roman Roland. In the United States, a manifesto attacking the Dewey Commission was signed by a number of authors, poets, professors, and artists, Theodore Dreiser, Granville Hicks, Corliss Lamond, and others. Speaking of the attitude of many British intellectuals to the trials, Julian Simons remarks on the monstrous incongruities that they willingly swallowed. He adds, but they had not been deceived. In relation to the Soviet Union they had deceived themselves, and in the end one has to pay for such self-deceits. In the non-communist, Popular Front-style left, there were signs of unease. Britain's leading journal of the intellectual left, The New Statesman, found the first trial unconvincing, yet added, we do not deny, that the confessions may have contained a substratum of truth. On the 1937 trial, it said, Few would now maintain that all or any of them were completely innocent. On the 1938 trial, which it claimed was undoubtedly very popular in the USSR, it said that the confessions remained baffling, whether we regard them as true or false, but that it could be concluded that there had undoubtedly been much plotting in the USSR, curiously combining a sense of the incredibility of the charges with a